Welcome to the A Minute to Midnight show. This is Tony. I'm recording this introduction retrospectively, and I have to say this is one heck of a good interview that you want to share with as many people as you possibly can. It's with Amir Tsarfati, and it is really full of information. Much of it I didn't know, and it dispels some of the myths that we have been told in the alternative media, etc., and gives us a real picture of what's going on in the Middle East and in the world as it fits in with Bible prophecy. I'm very pleased to be able to welcome Amir Tsarfati to this episode of the A Minute to Midnight show. It's great to be able to talk to you today, Amir.
Well, thank you very much. It's evening here by the Sea of Galilee, and I'm delighted to be on that show.
So, yeah, tell the listeners, you are based in Israel. You lived there all your life, I believe, and you actually live right next to the plains of Armageddon.
Correct. I was born in Jerusalem. I grew up in that area, and then I moved after I got married. I moved to live right below Mount Carmel at the edge of the Valley of Armageddon. So from my backyard, I see the Valley of Armageddon in front of me and Mount Carmel and to the right-hand side of me, and can't get more biblical than this one.
No.
So I'm a very blessed man.
That sounds amazing. Yes, definitely somewhere I'd love to visit at some point. So with you being right there in the Middle East, it sort of seems logical that we discuss what's going on as we move into the end of the end days, I think. And, of course, the Middle East is the focus of that. So we could look first at Syria. What do you see is going on there, and what's the game plan there at the moment?
Well, you know, first of all, I must say that what's going on in Syria is tragic. I mean, no matter what the biblical, you know, whole aspect of it, you know, just plain and simple, it's a tragic civil war that is entering into its fifth year right now with more than 500,000 casualties. And the world is just doing nothing to put an end to it. If anything, the world is contributing to the enhancement of that rather than to stop it. And biblically, I see an amazing importance in what's going on in Syria, because Syria, basically, or the situation in Syria, eventually gave birth to ISIS, and ISIS right now is the excuse that so many countries are using in order to enter into Syria and you know, using or taking advantage of the chaos there, trying to grab as much as they can. I'm talking about, you know, Russia, that used to have just a small naval base in Syria, and right now Russia is in full military power with several warships and an aircraft carrier on the sea, and you're talking about air, you know, aircrafts and tanks and soldiers and all of that on the ground. Then you have Iranian soldiers that are and an Iranian top commander that are actually running the operation around Aleppo and other places. You've got Syrian soldiers that are rolling into Syria from, excuse me, Turkish. That are rolling into Syria from Turkey. You know, their excuse is, of course, to somehow restrain ISIS, but in reality, what they really want to do is stop the advancing of the Kurds from creating their own state. And so everyone feels comfortable with the ISIS factor to be, you know, and everybody get into that picture with their own agenda. If it's Iran that wants to spread the Shiite Islam, if it's Russia that wants to control the gas and the oil in the Middle East, and if it's Turkey that wants to stop the expansion of the Kurds and wants to be a counterbalance to Iran. And so Syria becomes the playground, basically, of all the foreign and very contradicting interests of countries around us. And it's very interesting how the prophet Ezekiel, more than 2,700 years ago, could see that unholy alliance of Russia and Turkey and Iran, something that only civil war in Turkey, in Syria, managed to produce. But also the prophet Isaiah, I believe in chapter 17, describes how Damascus eventually will be a city that won't be able to be inhabited. It will be a heap of ruins in Isaiah 17:1. So I see a direct link between what the prophet said is going to happen and what is happening right now in the Middle East. And, you know, up until 5 years ago, most of the people around the world did not even know where Damascus is, literally. I don't think there's a single person today that doesn't know where Damascus is.
Yes.
It's quite amazing.
Yeah, it's the whole situation with the Middle East and the Arab Spring and all that, which I believe was largely planned and fomented by the Obama administration. And, you know, with Libya and even the coup in Egypt and whatnot. And so I think they had distinct plans for Syria. Only now everyone else has got involved, and so it hasn't probably worked out how they had hoped it would.
Exactly. And the reason is those key players don't play by the rules. You see, you know, the big powers behind this new world order and the global agenda are the powers of the Western European countries and America and some very, very influential billionaires. Russia doesn't play by the rules. You know, Russia never played by the rules. The only time Russia did play by the rules is when Russia was communist officially, and that was, you know, something that created a tension and a war that benefited in those families. But in reality, Putin is not really playing by the rules, and he's not playing alongside with Obama, but he's actually standing against him. And that, of course, caused a big problem over there. Also, you know, everyone has his own agenda and his own issues with the Obama administration. What Obama did in 8 years is damage that would take many, many more years to repair. I mean, all the 50 years of foreign diplomacy in the Middle East by America went down to the drains by those 8 years of Obama administration. No one trusts America in the Middle East. No one wants, in fact, people are staying away from it. In fact, Egypt is now having military exercises with Russia. You know, the Turks are one of the closest allies of America, is now running to the open arms of the Russians. Even the Israeli prime minister has to go to Moscow more than three times within 1 year to start coordinating issues with the Russians when it comes to activity in the Middle East. So the game has changed, the rules have changed, the players have changed, and everybody must adapt it himself to this new situation in the Middle East.
Yes, that's interesting. Talking about Obama, there is some talk of people wondering whether he will look to do the dividing of Israel and Jerusalem in his last couple of months. Do you see that as at all as a possibility?
Well, you know, I see that there's a good possibility that he's definitely going to no longer abstain or no longer veto any resolution that is calling for two states. But I'm not really worried, and let me explain why. I read my Bible, and I see two things. One, I don't see a Palestinian state there. Two, I see that Jerusalem will be a problem that eventually will cause the biggest war at the end of the tribulation, as Zechariah describes in chapter 12. So none of the resolutions of the UN right now, the Security Council right now, will have any effect or any immediate, you know, result at all. If anything, I believe that a new administration and a new approach will be causing the rage of the Muslims and the rage of the Europeans. And I don't think that a president that knows exactly what the next one's policy is going to be, I don't think it's worth the while for him to even try to take those type of steps. Obama was never, you know, as enthusiastic about Israel as he was with other countries. In fact, his legacy is not the peace in the Middle East as much as the Iran deal and others. I'm not worried, really. I just think that, you know, no one really takes him seriously anymore, especially in light of the new elections. If Hillary Clinton would have been the president-elect of America, then the things that Obama would have done now would carry a lot of weight, would carry a lot of meaning, a lot of importance. But he's a sitting duck right now. I mean, literally, there's someone that was voted into, you know, the White House that is going to change everything 180 degrees. So what's the point? Nobody takes him seriously already. It's the Russians are now bombarding Aleppo like crazy, even with chemical weapons, in defiance of all the American warnings and all the American concerns, because they don't see Obama anymore. He's not even there. He's not existent anymore. You know? He's only talking and doing nothing. As far as the Russians, this is the right time. Right now, when Obama is a sitting duck and Trump is not yet in the White House, to do as much as possible. So I'm not sure we should really worry about this.
I hadn't heard about chemical weapons being used in Aleppo. Is that actually confirmable? Or
Yes. From my sources, what's going on right now in the last 24, 36 hours in Aleppo eventually will come out. But the Russians are just going full force right now. And the problem is you have a 250,000 people trapped in an area with no hospitals, no medications, and no electricity. And a lot of people are, even without the chemical attack, a lot of people are just dying there just because of lack of medical treatment. And yes, chemical, and the world knows that, by the way. The world knows that. There has been use of chemical warfare in that area. And people say nothing. Let's remember, chemical weapon had been used. And America said that's the red line it won't allow Syria to cross. And Syria crossed it several times, and America did nothing. So what is going to stop them from using it again? They really need to bring about the Aleppo campaign to an end, because it more than 1,000 Iranian soldiers died. I mean, can you hear the number? 1,000 Iranian soldiers, not to mention Hezbollah terrorists, which is a proxy of Iran. And we're talking about over 3,000 of them that died. And Bashar al-Assad's force is almost not there. In fact, it's an Iranian general that runs the whole show in Aleppo. The Russians in Aleppo are just bombing from the air. They don't do anything else. And so there's so much frustration with the Sunni resistance in Aleppo that they decided to take off the gloves and just use whatever they can to bring an end to it.
So what do you think is Russia and Putin's end game there? What are they really trying to achieve by doing what they're doing in Aleppo?
Well, two things. Aleppo is Russia's biggest threat right now for the stability of the regime. Aleppo, let's face it, people don't know that, but Aleppo is bigger than Damascus, population-wise and size-wise. So Aleppo is the number one city in Syria. And if Aleppo falls in the hands of the Sunnis and the rebels, then let's face it, Syria is over. And the battle in Aleppo is the battle for the survival of the Syrian current regime. And I will tell you even more. The regime almost completely fell. And if it wasn't for Vladimir Putin, there would not be any more Syrian regime. If Vladimir Putin came probably about 7 to 9 days before, Syria would have been over. And he saved them at the last minute. But he did that for one reason. he did that to keep his interest in the Middle East. The Tarsus naval base that Russia owns, and of course his interest in gas and oil in the Middle East.
Yeah.
This is the only way for Russia to have a hold of the Mediterranean. This is the only Mediterranean base that Russia has. Russia is looking all around, and Russia sees NATO expanding. Russia sees America all around. Russia was very concerned. So for them, watching the falling and very crumbling Obama administration's foreign policy, they took advantage of it. They took advantage also of the fact that, you know, the UN is saying nothing and doing nothing. Let's face it, Russia invaded into the Ukraine. And Russia annexed a huge part of the Ukraine, and nobody did anything. Those sanctions are a joke, and so Russia and the Russian economy is plunging, and the Russians' reserves, cash reserves, are depleting, and the oil prices are way below what they have expected. It's below $50 a barrel, so they keep losing money every single day. And so for the Russians, it's money. They want to do business with Iran. They want to do business with Turkey. And they want to use the chaos in Syria to establish their presence there as the new Middle East superpower.
Well, if Russia hadn't done that, and the U.S. through ISIS, and I believe ISIS is a proxy army for the U.S., really, as Obama and Clinton, and they would have, if Russia hadn't stepped in, if Syria had have fallen, that would have been the end, yeah, because of the pipeline, the gas pipeline. America, through whoever puppet government they would have set up in Syria, would have controlled that completely. So you can understand why Russia would have gone, we can't allow that.
Yeah, and Russia also sees very concerning development with NATO and with the some missiles deployment in Romania and place and things like that, and Russia also sees that the Obama administration is not really honest with them. I mean, on one hand, they said we brokered a deal with Iran, so Iran is no longer a threat, and on the other hand, they put those missiles in Romania, and when they asked him why do they do that, they say because of the Iranian threat. So for the Russian president, this is, you know, are you kidding me? Mm. Obviously, it's against us, and he took it personally. And, you know, all it takes for Putin is to use that type of thing as an excuse to do whatever he wants. And you know what? For a period of about a week, there was a threat of an all nuclear war between the two countries.
Mm.
And that was not for nothing. It was because Vladimir Putin basically said, don't force me to start a nuclear exchange. And so right now, everybody's turning a blind eye on what he's doing in Syria because they don't want to make him angry. Because they understand there's a huge battery of nuclear warhead and ballistic missiles that is right now across from Finland in Kaliningrad. And so the world, you know, doesn't want that. So the world is willing to play, you know, the game. And Putin knows that.
Mm. Yeah, those missiles you're talking about, they could pretty much hit any of the major cities in Europe, couldn't they?
Exactly. And this is why he moved them. And by the way, he moved them not secretly. He moved them right underneath the eyes of the satellites, just as a defiance, and also as, look what I'm doing, and I'm serious. You know, I'm not even trying to hide anything. I am moving missiles that have the range to destroy any European capital, basically.
Yes.
And, you know, to the best of my knowledge, from Kaliningrad, those missiles have the range of reaching the East Coast also of America. So
that's pretty extreme. So Putin, then, do you think he has designs on Israel?
I think that for the time being, Putin prefers us on his side. Nothing is stable in Syria, nothing is stable in Iraq, and nothing is stable with America. And for the time being, Israel is probably the only stable thing in the Middle East, and he needs us on his side. But the moment he will feel that Israel is actually a liability and not a help, the moment he will feel that he can gain much more from our destruction rather than our existence, he's going to, you know, flip. It's very easy. Putin never showed any, you know, any loyalty to anyone that he's not interested in or that he doesn't have any, you know, some hidden agenda with. So Israel is not allowing Russia to have a portion of its gas and oil. And Russia is very disappointed. The Russian president wanted a stake in the Israeli gas. And we just said no. You know, so they're not our best friends, but at the moment, it serves their interest to keep us on their side.
Yes. So what about Jerusalem and the United Nations, the possibility of actually trying to internationalize it as a city? Do you think that is a goal?
Well, I believe that, you know, Jerusalem will be the biggest problem. You know, we've been pushing it away. We've been living in denial, but eventually it will come, and eventually it will, you know, it will become the issue, and that could be accelerated if America will move its embassy to Jerusalem, and the world will immediately run and say, okay, now if that happened, we need to make sure the world knows Jerusalem isn't the capital of Israel. So I'm not sure, but all I know is that my Bible tells me in Zechariah that it's Jerusalem that will be the problem of those nations, and they, because of that, they will come up against us.
Yeah, a burdensome stone at all.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
yep.
Then did you see that the Sanhedrin apparently is interested in getting Putin and Donald Trump to help them build a third temple?
Yeah, I want to. I'm probably the wrong person to talk to about the Sanhedrin because it's a joke. This whole team of people, self-appointed rabbis, nobody recognizes them in Israel besides themselves. And they can say whatever they want. Nobody listens to them. They're not an authority in Israel, none whatsoever. In Israel, we have a chief rabbis, and you have government, and you have military, and you have, you know, no one is, I mean, most of the Israelis didn't even know that there is a Sanhedrin. So, you know, it's good for Bible prophecy, you know, people who wants to see stuff happening. It's good for, you know, excited Gentiles from around the world. But I will be honest with you. This is one of those things that people make more of a fuss out of them around the world than in Israel itself. I can assure to you that not even a single newspaper in Israel wrote a single article, I'm talking about the major newspapers, about what you just said. Thanks. Wouldn't you think that, you know, that would be a main headline in Israel if there is a Sanhedrin that is asking Trump and Putin to build the third temple? No, don't get me wrong. The Trump effect is being felt in Israel. I mean, people already want to set some facts on the ground and build more, you know, more houses in Jerusalem and more houses in Judea and Samaria and stuff like that. But I would be, you know, honest with you. I don't take this Sanhedrin seriously. It's not a body that was elected by anyone.
That's really great to know coming from you in Israel because, you know, in the West, it's been, you know, it was sort of news and the alternative news anyway. So to hear that from you is really good. I'm glad you've brought that out.
Yes.
Do you actually think a move towards building a third temple?
Yes. And there has been a move like that for many, many years. There is a place in Jerusalem called the Temple Institute. It's an institute that is dedicated to the construction of the third temple and to the preparation for the third temple. Yeah, it's been there. I don't say it's not. And they do their best to collect money and reconstruct the vessels of the temple and start training priests for animal sacrifice and all that. That is indeed true. And they even released last year a DVD of the blueprints of what the temple is going to look like, which, by the way, I even posted on my website because I thought it's a very significant thing, you know. But from there to say that there is a Sanhedrin and they already asked Putin and Donald Trump to build the third temple, that's too much. You know, this is where I draw my line. And, you know, I like to deal with facts. I like to deal with things that really happen. And, you know, and that's probably the advantage I have living here in this country, speaking this language, coming from this culture and this religion and this heritage. You know, I can discern, I believe, what's really true and important and what's just the fruit of the imagination of a lot of people. You see, it always takes me back to, you know, Abraham and Sarah. And I'm thinking to myself, most likely a lot of those prophecy people would be those who convinced Sarah to tell Abraham to sleep with Hagar just so prophecy will be fulfilled, just so he will have a son.
Yeah.
And, you know, God has his own time for everything, and he's going to do it his way and according to his plan. And we shouldn't really push him or try to promote him to do things when, you know, when we know it, there it's going to happen. It's almost like, let's vote for an antichrist because we know an antichrist should come. Well, we don't have to deal with that. He will come, and it's none of our business.
So on that kind of line, I watched a DVD that you did, or I saw this a few months ago, where you did about an hour or so speaking about the Illuminati, and you went all the way back from the book of Genesis to today. And
correct.
And I thought that was great, you know, for what you condensed into such a short period of time. For I mean, I knew probably most of that stuff, but there were a few things I didn't even know. But for someone that didn't know, it was like the best thing I've heard on it. So that brings me to the point then, you know, you look at the Supreme Court building in Jerusalem, and it is so Masonic, so Illuminati, Rothschild money, you know, you can't miss it. It's like the ultimate almost tribute to them in a sense. So the Illuminati, what's the influence there now in Jerusalem and Israel, and could it be them that would be actually ultimately behind the building of any third temple? Because actually I've seen a model, scale model, photo of a scale model Freemasons put out, so, you know, that they were wanting to rebuild Solomon's temple and it was in a Masonic lodge. So I'm wondering.
It's interesting how you say that Solomon's temple, and the reason why I'm saying that is this whole thing of Solomon's temple is something that goes all the way back to even the Knights Templar and in the time of the Crusaders, who were in the land of Israel, in the city of Jerusalem, and the two Islamic structures that were there, they were renamed, one Templum Solomoni and one Templum Domini. So there was already then a yearning, a longing to somehow re-establish that Solomon's temple. And the Knight Templar was all about the fact that, you know, they had the quarters underneath the temple, or where the temple used to be. I would say this, and I hope everybody understands me correctly. Everything that has to do with the Jewish temple is demonic, satanic, and diabolic. And let me explain why. Let me expound on it. The Spirit of God left the temple when the temple was already standing, was still standing in Jerusalem. You read Ezekiel 8 and Ezekiel 9, Ezekiel 10, you see how the terrible pagan worship that took place while the temple was still standing in Jerusalem, that pagan worship of Tammuz and others caused the Spirit of God to just literally move all the way up to the east and go away. And so I believe that the Temple Mount has been given already, so to speak, as a satanic area to confuse the nations, to deceive the nations, and to deceive Israel as well. And so, because you and I know that when Jesus came, and the way he talked about the temple, and the way he talked about how the temple can be destroyed and rebuilt, and the way he talked about all of us, you know, first talking about himself, and then us being the temple of the Holy Spirit and all of that, we must understand that everything that has to do with the effort to build the third temple, by nature or in default, has to be satanic and diabolic, because we know that it is the Antichrist that is going to, you know, use it as his home. We know that he's going to be a tool of the enemy to deceive the Jews, to think that he is the Messiah. But once the way he behaves as declaring himself as God will cause them to immediately flee, to immediately go away. And we see that everything that has to do with the temple is blindness that had happened to Israel, unfortunately. And when Jesus will come back and his feet will stand on Mount of Olives, everything is going to be destroyed. No matter what is standing on that temple mount, it's going to be gone. In fact, that earthquake that is going to happen, as Zechariah describes, and that big valley that will be created from east to west, that will create a river flowing from east to west, from the Mediterranean to the Dead Sea, will basically bring up the gate that now is sunk under the rubble, that eastern gate, and Jesus would be walking through it, as Psalm 24 suggests. And it's interesting because only when Jesus will come, there will be a clean and worthy temple that Ezekiel describes in the last few chapters of his book. So all the efforts for the third temple are efforts that are either done intentionally by Illuminati-affiliated organizations or unintentionally. I don't believe that the Jewish people, the Temple Institute, is doing anything with the knowledge that this is the wrong temple. They are truly 100% convinced it is the right thing. So they have been deceived, and they are the deceivers, and both the deceivers and those that are being deceived are pushing the idea of something that is, diabolic. Will it not happen? No, of course it will happen. Can we stop it? Of course we cannot stop it. Why can't we stop it? Because God knows the nature of man. God knows, that people always choose to believe the lie. So they will choose to believe the lie, and they will understand their big mistake. And this is why when Jesus comes back, after their temple has been destroyed, after all of that has happened, all the descriptions, whether it's in the New Testament or in the book of Revelation or the Old Testament in the book of Zechariah, describes how the Jewish people will mourn. You would think that they see Jesus and they will be so happy dancing in the streets. They will mourn. They will mourn because alongside with the revelation of him as their true Messiah, everything else is gone. Everything else is destroyed. And they will understand how big of a mistake they have made, they have done. So that's why the Bible talks about like Yom Kippur, like the Day of Atonement of the Jewish people on that date that he returns. If you read the latter chapter, the latter words of Zechariah 12, you see that they mourn and they cry. Then they looked at him whom they pierced and they mourn. They mourn and they cried. They realized this is the one whom we thought is, he's a false Messiah, he's a wrong person. After all, he was all along the right person. which means we were wrong to think that the person who offered us the third temple was the right person. Because it's the Antichrist. The Antichrist is going to promote the third temple. He's going to be happy about that. He's going to walk in and declare himself as God. So this whole promotion of the third temple is a diabolic, satanic thing. And they will understand that only when Jesus will come back. So it's a good thing, but it's a sad thing at the same time, that it'll take them that long, that many casualties, and that much suffering to go through in order to realize the big mistake that they did and the truth of Jesus himself being the true Messiah and King of Israel.
I'm glad, you know, you've brought that out, particularly for Christians that are thinking they should be putting money into the third temple, which I think is completely
terrible.
Crazy.
Yeah. Terrible. It's terrible. We I would even add to this, we must, if we want to do something, be about our Father's business, we don't need to, you know, promote prophecies. All we need to do is to share the gospel. And the Bible tells us that we need to be not only ready for the time that he's coming to take us, but also to be found working for the kingdom, you know, and not just, you know, be about our own things. Definitely. I believe God gives everyone talent, time, and resources. And when we will, you know, when he will take us, he's going to ask us, what did you do with the time, with the money or resources, and the talents that I gave you? What did you do with it? So
that's great. That's great advice. Yes. One thing that's perturbed me and bothered me with a lot of the alternative media type, truth exposes supposedly, or truth movement or whatever, is how pro-Palestinian a lot of them are, and even amongst the Christians, and saying, well, it's not political Israel, God doesn't bless political Israel, and basically Israel as a nation shouldn't exist, kind of thing, which to me I'm horrified at, because I firmly believe that the state of Israel I fully support its existence, but at the same time, there's this juxtaposition, I suppose, with knowing that a heck of a lot of Rothschild money went into the creation of the state of Israel, and we know the Rothschilds are Illuminati.
You know, the Rothschilds' money went to the creation of the Federal Reserve of America. It went to the creation of many institutions in many countries all around the world, and it serves their purpose also, that there was always going to be a conflict between Jews and Arabs, a conflict between communists and capitalism. And so it's the religious war, and it's the financial war, and it's the spiritual war, and it's the doctrinal war. I mean, that's what they make their money and their fame, is not peace, it's war.
Yeah.
And yeah, so maybe they contributed here and there, but let's not forget that many Jews died because of the effort of the Illuminati to cover up their tracks. I believe, by the way, I have to be very clear about this. First of all, only about 10-15% of the wealthy families, of the most wealthiest families in the world that are running the show behind the scenes, only about 15% are Jewish. I mean, it's 85% non-Jewish, you know, bottom line. But I will also say that these Jews don't consider themselves Jews. Being Jews is not in their agenda even. And when the Bible talks about people who call themselves Jews, but they're actually from the synagogue of Satan, I believe it talks about these people, that they may have Jewish blood, but they are globalists. It's above and way above and beyond, you know, Jews or non-Jews. For them, it's they have seen the light, and they have the capacity of ruling the world, and they know, and all of that. You know, as you watched in my message about the Illuminati, for them, it's the illuminated, they've been illuminated by the light of Lucifer, So when the Bible says they're synagogue of Satan, that's what it's talking about. These people serve Satan. You know, they may have Jewish names or some Jewish heritage, but they have absolutely no regards to it. They are on the camp or part of the camp of Satan himself.
Yes, yeah, and you've only got to look at people like George Soros as an example of a Jew that basically sold his own people out to the Nazis.
Exactly. He sold his own people. And you have to understand, the Rothschild even gave money to Hitler.
Yeah.
And the Rothschild gave money to Hitler on one side, and they gave money to Stalin on the other side. I mean, for them, it served their interest. And so, again, they don't look at Jews or non-Jews. They may have Jewish heritage or name, but that's where it stops. They truly belong to the synagogue of Satan. They belong to a group of people that Satan is their leader, and they worship him. And they don't even hide it. They really don't. There were the days when these people were hiding it. Today, people worship Satan out in the open, and they're even proud of it.
Yes. I know a lot of people say that Putin is anti-New World Order and against the New World Order. I have a different take on it, and I think it's quite possible that Putin is not anti the New World Order or the Illuminati, etc., but that there's a sort of a vying for top dog position within that New World Order, and that Russia wants a top role in the New World Order. Not that he's necessarily against it, but, you know, there's this whole thing, same with China. And I could be wrong there, but that's kind of how I wonder whether it's all still a part of the game, the playing off the money, the war, Rothschilds, etc., and the funding, how they funded both sides of wars, World War One, World War Two. You know, after World War One, they had the Germans on one side as the thesis, and you had the other countries and the antithesis, and then you had the synthesis, which was the League of Nations. Then after the Second World War, you had the Nazis and the Germans, and you had the Europeans and Americans and the thesis, antithesis, and then they brought the United Nations out of it. And I wonder if we've got a same sort of game going on now, pushing towards a third world war to bring the Antichrist system into play. But
yeah.
Without going too much there, it makes me think of the whole Gog and Magog war, which we see in Ezekiel, and you couldn't have that without there being a state of Israel. So the people that say that Israel doesn't belong, you know, it's all spiritual Israel where there's no longer an Israel because Christians are it and all that. Well, you got to only look at those chapters 38, 39 and go, well, hang on a second. There's only one way to reconcile those chapters, and that's with there being an actual literal Israel.
Yeah. You know, and it's also beyond that. The minute you say that Israel don't necessarily anymore exist as God's people and that the church had replaced Israel, you literally took away two things. You take away that which is written in Jeremiah 31, that only when the stars and the moons and the sun will cease to exist, then Israel will no longer be people before God. And you move also to the New Testament, Romans 11. You know, Romans 11 was actually written by Paul because he could see replacement theology born already in the first century. And so he starts the whole chapter with, hey, there is no such thing. It's rubbish. Has God forgot the people whom he foreknew? No. And he says, certainly not. Is the most strongest Greek word to say no. And then he goes on and he says, because the gifts and the callings of God are irrevocable. And not only that, he even went on and said that eventually all Israel will be saved. So if Israel has a plan, and eventually after all of that, Jesus will come back and they will see him, and all Israel at that moment will be saved, then Israel has to exist. Then Israel has to mean something to God. Then if he returns to Jerusalem, then and then they will see in the one whom they pierced, then Jerusalem has to be part of Israel. So there's so much that, you know, if the minute you, and what about the fact that if God changed his mind about Israel, how can he not change his mind about you tomorrow? I mean, that alone should be a problem for you. So there's so much, you know, that is there, hanging there. And I just don't see a problem with political Israel. I mean, with all the respect, Ezekiel describes a political entity. He's not describing a spiritual entity. You know, safe and secure, you know, unwalled villages. It's not, you know, you're not talking about synagogues and temples. You're talking about towns and cities and villages. You're talking about a state, a country. So, you know.
What do you think then about people that are of Jewish heritage now that are not in Israel? Do you see that they're all going to end up in Israel, or how does that, you know, with the hook in the jaw thing and
I will tell you that I'm not a prophet. You know, I always tell people I come from a non-profit organization, but I can tell you that the heart of God, as I can see in Ezekiel 36 and 37, is that he wants his people to come back to his land. And he's willing to facilitate it himself. And the return of the Jews back to the land is a big miracle that people cannot explain in words today. You know, what happened in the late 19th century, in the beginning of 20th century, is unheard of. Show me one country that within 1 to 2 years absorbed 3 new immigrants for every person that lived there. And that's basically what happened in Israel. You know, between 1948 and 1950, we have absorbed, you know, so many people. And there is no country that could, I mean, and Israel was a poor country. Even wealthy countries, let's take America, for example. America is a very wealthy country. Forget about the national debt. Let's talk about the money that is there. You know, America, do you think America, being with 350 million people, do you think America can absorb 1 billion new immigrants over the course of 2-3 years? Of course not. There's no such thing in history. There's no such thing in modern history. And so Israel is a miracle. Nobody can explain how we win the wars when the Arabs were always much stronger militarily. Nobody explains how we managed to, you know, thrive financially when we are in a state of war our entire life. Nobody can explain how the land that the Arabs could swear that nothing grows there, nobody can explain how that land bears so much fruit and vegetables right now. Nobody can explain the innovation of the people of Israel, you know, in so many areas. And that is, of course, the way God preserves them. That's the way God is displaying his lordship and his kingship and his faithfulness is being on a display here, you know. And even in Ezekiel 36, he says, "I will bring you back from the land, so the world will see, so the nations will see that I am God." So Israel is a way that God speaks to the whole world. So what is it that Satan does? Satan says, "Hey, Israel has no right to exist. Israel is not even there. Don't even look at Israel." So you see, God wants the world to learn from Israel who he is. And Satan wants the world to think that Israel is not important, that Israel is a mistake, that Israel is not, you know, really belong to that area. And you can see the schemes of the devil.
You can, yeah.
And by the way, last thing about the devil. His name is the deceiver, a liar and deceiver. And the only thing that makes someone a deceiver is the knowledge of the truth. When you say something wrong, you're just wrong. But when you know the truth and you say the opposite, that makes you a deceiver. And so if Satan is the deceiver, that means he knows that whatever he says is actually wrong. And he knows that the truth is exactly the opposite. So if the world hates us, that means God loves us. If the world thinks this is not our land, that means this is indeed our land. If the world thinks that God is through with Israel, that means God is not through with Israel. See, everything that he says to people is deception. And deception by nature is the opposite of truth, but with the knowledge of the truth. So he knows exactly what Israel is for God. And that's why he says, he keeps feeding the people with the opposite.
That's brilliant. Yes, absolutely. That's a fantastic description. Can you tell our listeners where they can find you on the internet, your website?
Yes. First of all, my website is beholdisrael.org. But also I have an app, a free app on App Store, on Google Market, and it's called Behold Israel. And the cool thing about the app, if they download it, is that, first of all, it's free of charge. And then they get news every day from Israel. They get push notifications with anything that comes up with or with stuff. Whenever I'm about to do a Facebook Live or prophecy update, they get an alert. And there's daily update of news that I believe people should be aware of. And it's cool. You can find on the app also news and articles and blogs and also the resources that we have for people to get. And I, of course, the apart from the website and the app, people also can find us on the Facebook. I've got Behold Israel as a Facebook page and also Amir Tzarfati as a Facebook page. They can subscribe on our YouTube channel, Behold Israel. And every time I post something, it'll be on YouTube as well. They can find us there. We have a Twitter account also. And Instagram, Behold Israel, one word, on Instagram. And that's basically where people can find us. My ministry is basically divided to three. It's teaching around the world, teaching online, and teaching people in Israel when they come on a tour with me. And I take them around and I teach them Bible on location. So that teaching ministry is basically spreading on these three legs. So
that's great. Now, do you have any final things, words that you want to share with our listeners?
I just want to, tell people that, things are accelerating. It's such a fast track that the world is going, on. And I just hope people understand that God really wants them to get ready and also, of course, to get right with him, but also to be about his business. And whether you are a pre-trib, mid-trib, post-trib, I don't care. You need to be ready. That's what the Bible says. We need to be ready. And, no one knows the day and the hour. So we need to be ready no matter what. We can't really continue playing church. There's too much complacency, too much. People are just dealing with themselves and their own fame and their own name and their own on the numbers. How many people follow me? How many people are watching me? How many people are doing this? It's just becoming another business and another alternative lifestyle. And it's just not, it lost its genuine, real reason to exist even. We really need to be about our Father's business. And in this period, I believe that, let's say right after Trump has won and a lot of Christians are relieved right now, I believe that God gave America a very, very short time of grace to roll up their sleeves and work hard, not to just go back to bed and sleep. And so not only America, we're going to see that crisis of leadership and across Europe and in other places around the world. And I just believe that there's not much time left and there's much work left to do. So just, get ready yourself and roll up the sleeves and just be about a Father's business. There's so much to do.
Great, great finishing words. I want to thank you so much, Amir, for being on the A Minute to Midnight show today. That's just been a fabulous interview. I really got a lot.
Thank you very
that.
Much. Thank you. And God bless you guys. And it was a pleasure speaking to you today from the Sea of Galilee, from where 2/3 of the gospel took place.
Great. Thank you.
God bless you. Shalom. Bye-bye.
I found that interview fascinating and I learned a lot from it myself. And you can find all of our interviews at www.aminutetomidnight.com, and we post them there as audio and as video. And we have a donation button on the website. We run this ministry through donations, and we are so grateful to the small group of people that do contribute to our show and our website and producing the articles, etc. And if you feel led to do it, we would greatly appreciate any help that you can give us there. And I write and record all the music for our shows and play it, and so this is my music underneath it. And you can find my royalty-free production music at rockshoresounds.com, and there's also a link to that on the A Minute to Midnight website. We have a Facebook group, which Brooke runs and does a great job of it. So you're welcome to join our Facebook group if you want to contribute to conversations around some of these topics and others as well. So that's about it for today. This is Tony signing off for the A Minute to Midnight show.